throw it out here.
Did my voice come through as
beautiful? Fine, I should have brought the tape. I should have brought the tape we did in, but I didn't think about it. I should let you hear.
Usually a voice from in the high register records better than a voice in the low register if you load a TV announcer.
This is a very good...
Never a basis.
This is a very good little recorder. It picks up. This is tape two with an interview with Dr. Black, and we're going to just more or less pick up where we left off the other day, Dr. Black. Let's start. You mentioned just a minute ago about Dr. Tiger's arrival, and University College perhaps is an outgrowth of this about the same time.
Right.
Let's talk about that some.
Dr. Tiger's arrival was interesting. I forget the name of the individual involved, but the university had just come to an impasse with respect to a new president, and one of the board of control happened to be in Washington. Heard Dr. Tiger's next speech. Came right back home and told our board of control, I found the man for president. That's how Dr. Tiger got there. Mm-hmm. Purely accidental. His educational background, because he was National Commissioner of Education, was of course the idea behind which evolved our University College. Because at that time, the thinking over the country hadn't gone that far. And I think only Chicago and perhaps Minnesota were the only two in the whole United States. So Dr. Tiger was able to make a quicker imprint on the state and the U.S. as he could.
Right.
Brought in this new idea and called on Dean Walter J. Mattingly, Dr. Winston Little, and myself to each take a year off from our respective duties and come to his office and organize what was then called the General College.
Mm-hmm.
It later on became the University College. We did take a year off. We had to do our homework. Mainly me, because Dr. Little, of course, was being in education, has got a much better background than I did. Mm-hmm. We all did our own work and began to organize and interview people and study and conduct researches on the campus.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found was, as Tiger had claimed, that the indiscriminate choices that high school children make before coming to college were about 95% wrong. They think they want to be an engineer or a chemist or a doctor or you name it, when actually they have no aptitude for that. And the records of the freshman and sophomore and junior years showed hundreds of transfers a year from college to college because of people rectifying their mistakes. The idea behind the University College was to have a two-year curriculum which would fit any college. That's why it was called the University College, a general college. And during which time, aptitude tests could be given to these students, and in that junior year, not before, they would make a choice of a profession, or at least a choice of a goal which they wanted to achieve. And the records since that time, I think, have amply established that to be true, because now most universities have an organization of that sort.
Less,
although Florida was a pioneer.
Less transfers and more guided career. Program.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
After
that's right.
University
so now
college.
The transfer between colleges is much smaller because by the time they elect their college, they pretty much know because they've tested themselves. They've been tested by their professor.
Mm-hmm.
What they want to do and why they want to do it. This is good. This is good. Also, we produce an awful lot of duplication of courses in different colleges.
Mm-hmm.
One course could cut off a lot. The objective, of course, is that the classes are very large. And it requires a very fine, high-type, dynamic type of teacher to hold the attention of that many students over that length of time.
What was the actual mechanics of it now? How did you all go about it, the three of you? You said you spent most of the, or dean.
Well, we met with individual deans.
Mm-hmm.
For example, as you might suppose, engineering was very strongly opposed to University College.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted their boys just as soon as they could get them. And we didn't have medicine in those days, but I expect they would have been too, although I'm not sure about that.
Mm-hmm.
But the professional schools looked upon it with some skepticism. Arts and science and education worked in with open arms. So we had their friendship. But we worked with these deans and met with the deans themselves and their faculties time after time. We were pretty busy. And we had a committee report after committee report. The details I forgot because it's been a long time. But finally, the final report which we made to the president, strongly recommending our University College, was adopted.
Mm-hmm.
We have just on the wire, personally have just alluded to with Gainesville to explain to the city of Gainesville what it was. And the three of us made talks around the state to various voters and wanted to explain this new thinking in education. Mm-hmm. And I think by and large, it was pretty well received by everyone.
I was going to say, how did the public receive this?
Pretty well, mm-hmm. pretty well.
That's the philosophy and the mechanics of it. You think only probably the professional schools were the ones that were somewhat leery about the
engineering requested to be admitted, which we refused to do.
Do you find that still more or less the feeling up to this time?
I suspect maybe it is. You know, I suspect that if there's less enthusiasm in various parts of the campus, I think you'd find the least enthusiasm among the professional schools. Mm-hmm. And the greatest enthusiasm in the Art College of Arts and Science and education and that kind of.
Students I've talked to over the years have sometimes balked at it, but I think in the end they've appreciated the chance to kind of discover what's what.
That's right.
And so forth.
I think the things that have happened in the last 10 or 15 years so greatly emphasize the objectives of the General College because the failure in this country today is not in technology. We've made technological advances which are amazing to ourselves as well as to the world. But its social implications we don't understand very well.
It's very important.
Our great need today is to apply a helpful sociological way the things which we have done. That's when you fall down.
That's a very good point.
And that is the thing which the General College ought to make easier to do as years go by.
That's good. That's a very good point. Dr. Tigard, of course, was behind all of this, you know, just cutting red tape, I guess, and going around and other people and everything.
He was a doer. didn't hesitate to cut red tape or to talk to people very straight.
Yeah.
If they need to be talked to that way. He was a strong man. Dr. Tigard, in my opinion, was by all odds, the strongest of the four presidents under my chair, which would be Miller, Tigard, Murphy, and Rice. Mm-hmm. Of those four, I would testify in the deputy for it, which is not surprising because he came from a very strong administration at the national level.
Mm-hmm.
And a broader outlook. And I will forget when he came, he had, this is something which politicians always do, his whole office, which is the Harvey Lloyd Room in Anderson Hall, was filled with autographed pictures of the people of whom I've heard for many years, but never seen. He had the hallway outside was filled with these autographed pictures. It was very impressive to him.
Good friend of FDR, I think.
That's right.
So forth.
That's right.
Yeah, did FDR ever come here? I think he was invited, but he never did come.
I don't think he ever came.
Yeah.
Mr. William Jennings Bryan not only came here, but gave a course here and was here frequently in his later years. Mm-hmm. He then moved to Miami, and during the boom, Mr. Bryan would give a sales talk to big development corporations and land.
Mm-hmm.
His ability to speak was so great.
By the time you got here, I think this is a little bit of a side point. The evolution controversy had more or less passed over, but I was talking to one of the biology professors. He said there was some controversy here in the 20s and early 30s about how to teach evolution, but it was pretty much smoothly handled. Dr. Byers, I was talking to
about
it. Did you run into any of that here?
I saw Dr. Byers the other day, purely by accident. He's been away for a long time, and I just moved back to Gainesville. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right across from one of the grocery stores. I said, we must get together sometime.
Yeah.
For a long talk. He and I were very good friends.
He's very interesting to talk to.
Yeah, I must leave that because, yes, I remember the diet that is true.
In agriculture or anything, did you have any contacts with Dr. Murphy's attitudes? Or you mentioned William Jennings Bryan. That's what made me think of it, you know, when he came.
Well, Dr. Murphy was an ardent Baptist, and I suspect was pretty much of a fundamentalist. Mm-hmm. So I suspect Dr. Berkeley, I don't remember what it was, trod very little carefully. He didn't dare stand up, I guess, against the scientists. Yeah. All of them, of course, would adopt Darrow's attitude.
Yeah.
I was going on the train to Miami one time back in those days. I had a lot of outside contacts, even early. And Mr. Brown was on the train, and we sat together and talked for a long while. and we talked about it with us. Never will forget one phrase which he used with me, I'm sure. I think he used it also with others. He said, "Dr. Black, I'm much more interested in the Rock of Ages than the Age of Rocks."
Oh, yeah.
You remember that? He told me that personally. And he gave talks on the campus, emphasizing fundamentalism and religion. Mm-hmm. And of course, his position, that was well known by everyone. We've survived that, as we've survived many other tempests, and I'm sure we'll survive the one we're in now. Right. Although the solution doesn't seem as clear at the moment.
You talk about political.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, as a water chemist, you should be interested in Watergate.
For sure.
All right, let's talk about now some of your work during the war. This brings us into the war. I know you were connected with the Army and the Navy in research and development and so forth.
Right.
And had your private corporation gotten off the ground at this time, or was this after the war?
I came here in 1919. It was 1924 or 25. When St. Augustine came over after I'd gone to Harvard and studied for a year and come back, that they got in touch with me on that very first project.
This was Black Industries, now
I was just A.P. Black, and my son was just still in high school. Mm-hmm. And the war came on, and Charles and Bill Trouble both went to Europe. Charles in England and Bill for Germany. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were sophomores. Then at the end of their sophomore year, they went to the cities and so came back. And that would be in the middle 40s.
Right.
And they both ended as juniors and finished up as juniors and seniors. Mm-hmm. During that time, I had built up a consulting practice all over the state, many, many, many cities. I was helping the State Board of Health do their job because they were understaffed at no cost to them. And we decided to form this little laboratory and did so. Mm-hmm. That was 1947.
How did the university look at this now? You know, this is probably a touchy area, but you know, if you don't mind,
The business itself was well received because by that time, the Florida had begun to grow very rapidly. Mm-hmm. It was realized that Florida, like every other state, had water problems, and somebody had to solve them. And I was so well received all over the state, and had so many friends everywhere that I came through with a minimum of difficulties. Mm-hmm. My early consulting work, even before that, was in toxicology. Mm-hmm. So somebody brought in a sample from a dead body. When Dr. Lee was chairman of the department, and I was his only assistant, and we got out the toxicology books. The state had no laboratory in those days, and analyzed the thing and solved it.
That's hard to
and
believe.
And that got me interested in toxicology, so I began to delve into it and offered a course in toxicology. And Dr. J. Martin Pierce, who later became a member of the staff of the Chemistry Department, was one of my best students. And another one, whose name I forgot at the moment, graduated with toxicology major, went to Miami as a toxicologist for the Gulfstream racetrack, and became and retired as chief toxicologist of the state of New York, who became one of the first toxicologists in the country. Mm. So it was sent to France by the New York Department of whatever it is, for special training, and became a toxicologist by profession. Mm-hmm. That was purely an upside, and when my water activities soft up, I dropped it, all the toxicology completely, turned it over to Dr. C.B. Pollard, and Dr. Pollard himself made quite a reputation in toxicology before he died.
How is that name spelled? What is
P-O-L-L-A-R-I-D, Pollard. S-C-B Pollard. So he was a man that I told you was so distinguished in research in chemistry, and
right.
I think that the new buildings
right.
should be named Pollard Hall.
Right. That's right.
I hope to be able to do that before I'm too much older.
I recall that now. During the war, what did you do now besides?
I was sent to the Bureau of Standards in Washington, but we're at Camp Humphreys, which is just across the river in Virginia. And we had to drill on Saturday morning, but during the week we worked in the laboratories. Worked solving the various problems that came in. We worked on machine gun belts, rifle grenades, balloon fabrics. These are things that I remember. They were building concrete ships in those days. Steel was very scarce and they would crack. We had to develop paints and cements that would span cracks so that the ships wouldn't leak. Mm-hmm. Things of that sort. And that kept us pretty busy. And when the war was over, The university offered me the job, which they'd offered me in 1917, which I refused. Florence Western looked a lot bigger than Florida to me. They offered to come to the university, came in 17, while I was in boot camp, went in to go to Western. So for active service, I'm already in the Army. But my presiding commanding officer said, "Dr. Burke, if you want to go, we'll let you transfer to Florida." That's not a pretty big to him, too. I said, "No, I don't want to." So I turned it down and went to Western. And when the war was over, my professor in Texas had been transferred to Florida by this time. He brought me, well, he had, that was what, and I think, and I've been here ever since.
Did you remain in Florida during the war, I guess, mostly?
No.
You went to Washington?
Went to Washington. We lived there.
I'm trying to say.
I'd never been out of Texas.
Did you go overseas or anything?
I left in Texas. I had my boot camp training in Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
And San Antonio. Austin and San Antonio.
Yeah. Right. That's interesting. What about when the you came back after the war now, and this great influx of veterans, you know, after the Second World War? And of course, women were beginning to come to university about this time, weren't they? Something 48?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. I know they made a special provision for a young woman named Margaret Thomas. Mm-hmm. She was a daughter of Dr. Thomas, that great man who Thomas Hotel, the man who was sent to both the university from Lake City to Gainesville. Mm-hmm. And because of his prominence and what he'd done for the university, the same as the department, they were allowed her to come to some of our courses. That's the first woman I remember. Mm-hmm. And there were various special cases like that, and pretty soon the bill was passed in Tallahassee that and see, Tallahassee had only women and we had only men to make the two institutions co-educational. I forgot that date, but from that time on, of course, although Tallahassee still has, I believe, more women than men, and we had more men than women.
No great changes. I guess all the men were happy to see this come about.
That was an outgrowth of the old, we might say, we call it moral South, and our forefathers thought that boys and girls couldn't go to school together and be just everything they should be. So if you look over the South and Southeast, a lot of the finer schools, not co-educational. And there's a religious background. That's what I've always heard. I wouldn't know if that's true.
Well, that's of course like Yale, you know, Yale is just beginning to.
That's right.
Women,
that's right.
Of course, they're
that's
1701. You know.
That's right. And of course, Harlow, I guess, never has.
I'm not sure. I think from the graduate school.
Harlow, of course, they have Smith College, right? The graduate school, I'm sure they do.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Let's see here. You're coming along now. You're, at this time, you're a research professor. And in 49, you become chemistry department head. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that a little bit now. Who did you take over? Was this Dr. Lee still?
Dr. Lee, yes, sir. Dr. Lee had died. Mm-hmm. Very suddenly, I believe.
He was rather elderly, there, wasn't he? Hmm? Wasn't he rather elderly about this time?
Yeah, he was getting along, but he wasn't old enough to retire. Mm-hmm. And I was a younger man than most. Dr. Heath was older than I was, and Dr. Jackson was older than I was. They were both much dearer at times, but they were in the chemistry department at that time. I had brought in a number of young men. Dr. Baxter probably is the best known of the men that I hired. Dr. Baxter has since been very widely acclaimed nationally for his work in freshman chemistry and has traveled all over the world and been in great demand. And Dr. Baxter was, I guess, the first man I employed after I became chairman of the department. I've always been very proud about that because he didn't make a very good impression when he came to the campus. And if I had put his nomination to a vote of the faculty, they wouldn't have chosen him. So I didn't do it. I wrote to his professor. He was at the University of West Virginia, I believe. I'm not sure. University of Maryland. Mm-hmm. William and Mary.
I see.
Asked his permission to make Dr. Baxter an offer, which I received, and I made him an offer, and he came. And he became one of our most distinguished professors. So there were a group of older men, mm-hmm. and a group of younger men. I was in the middle. I guess that's probably where I was chosen, except also that I was pretty active on campus. And that same year, this may have had something to do with it, Time magazine conducted a national poll of a number of universities, which Florida was one, and had the faculty of each of these universities choose two outstanding faculty members and finest teachers on campus. And those two were written up in the national write-up. And while Bill Donovan and myself were chosen as two outstanding teachers. This was the same year I made the Bubba Gemma. There's probably some relationship between the two, I wouldn't know, but I suspect there is. Mm-hmm. Professor Donovan and myself were chosen as the two best teachers from the county. And I served for some 8 years at that. It was a mistake as far as my professional life's concerned.
It's a lot of expansion.
That's
though.
Right. I would never suggest to any man actually interested in the state to become an administrator. Because during that 8 years, as I recall, I didn't get a single publication. And my creative work had to be turned into administration, which is not very rewarding. You have everybody who shovels and words you on. And if I had it over do over again, I wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. But since when I became, I could do my full time to research, those were the most productive years of my life. And they have continued since my retirement because I've published 34 papers since I retired and won several national awards since I retired.
How was the department set up and organized in this, 8 or 9 years there?
Pretty much the same as other departments. We had a chairman, we had committees of all kinds, we had a salary committee. Then they would vote on it and suggest the people who would be the best qualified, but the faculty themselves, they've done the best job and should have an advance in salary. And the library committee and this, that, and the other. Most departments are organized with a committee system. Very democratic.
What about the curricula now? That's freshman English, of course, and then you went into your regular inorganic and organic, and how was the graduate school coming along in those days?
Graduate school, well, by the time I was chairman of the department, we had a well-organized graduate school, and to give not only the best, but to give us a PhD. We gave University of Kansas for the department for many years, Kansas for the farmers. Take just about all a PhD for some years. Then biology began to come in, and bacteriology, the sciences first, and then of course it spread out. And Dr. Pollard, that's the reason why I think the building should be a Lady Pollard Hall. Dr. Pollard was the finest research man, not a prophet at that time. Well, that's a big question. Later on, my publication, you see it here, but not at that time. He died way much too young.
About this time, then Dr. Miller was arriving on the scene. Let's see, were you still department head when he came?
I'm not sure if I was or not. I probably was.
56, you went back as a research professor.
Dr. Miller brought some new ideas to the campus.
Yeah, let's talk about
and the
him.
State, one of the cleverest things he did, which has not been continued since that time, although I'm still a member, he organized a society called the Newcomen, N-E-W-C-O-M-E-N, the Newcomen Society. The Newcomen Society still exists in this country. I'm a member of it, and I get each month its publications. What it really is a group, it was organized by a group of Britishers in New York, very wealthy British men. And they have a meeting once a year. They usually at the Beer Hotel, which is the most plush hotel in New York, and everybody that wants to come is invited. And they have, over the country, their sponsor, the president of a corporation, wants himself to be well-known and his corporation to be well-known. So they will publish a beautifully embossed booklet, which is the history. The text, Tom Martin, who organized the Southern Research Institute, was head of the York Power Corporation. The York Power Corporation had one for it, honoring Mr. Martin. And so it goes. And Dr. Miller was a member of this society, so one of the first things he did when he came here was to ask a selected number of the faculty, which I was one, and a few of us, and then people over the state, notably legislators, mayors of cities, growers. It was a good idea. And these people came to the campus, and we had these big dinners about three or four a year, when they could get together and socialize. And I thought that was a very good day. I'm sorry that it wasn't continued, but it was not. Mm-hmm. But on a national basis, it's still going strong. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the first approaches he made to sending the university to the state. It was at a very high level and in a very limited fashion, but to the people that really count.
It Something like a council of 100.
Then he realized, as everybody did by that time, that we didn't have nearly enough doctors in the Florida with a rapidly growing population, simply had to have a medical school. So he began to do that. Appointed Dr. Poor, P-O-O-R, Dr. Poor, had come here from Mississippi, was, I think, in the biology department, a geologist. And Dr. Poor was placed in charge of that. And
and the organization now, the medical school, getting it set up academically and so
they had over 200 consultants. Dr. Poor, they was organized with the research motive in mind. And it is that today, a tremendous research institution, ranking with some of the very best in the whole United States. But I understand that the total number of consultants employed before the thing was finally finalized was more than 200. I was on the committee of about 10 or 12 of us of that organized this junior.
What aspect did you...
I don't think any of us had special aspect. They said the people who they thought knew the faculty pretty well. Not all the faculty received it. A lot of faculty thought it was too much competition. Some of the departments thought they'd be swallowed up. Biology was deathly afraid of it. As a matter of fact, biology has lost some of their biggest sub-departments to this. Microbiology is now in medicine, but it used to be in biology. And so it goes. Mm-hmm. So the drug wasn't all.
I would have thought the complete opposite, you know.
That's right. But it was was finally organized and got off to a real good start. And I think it has grown spectacularly over the years. I realized pretty much how, because my own daughter was administrative assistant to Dr. Edward Ackle, who has just left in the last couple of months to go to California. And she was over in his office about 6 years and was intimately familiar with and had a part in. During the war, just before she took this job, she lived in Tallahassee, and she was in the governor's office for a while, and she was secretary to two or three of the most prominent legislators, and she had excellent Tallahassee contacts, which the medicine school got badly needed. Mm-hmm. So that made a very, very opportune appointment for them, and she was able to be able to get used to them until she realized that she told me so many things about the school and higher ranks.
It's been said that when Dr. Miller arrived, Florida began to take on a national reputation. Would you agree with that, pretty much, generally speaking?
Well, I think we had a national reputation before that time because of the University College. But that was just in one area.
Right.
I think probably that's true, yeah, because the state was getting bigger, we were getting more cosmopolitan, our budget was getting bigger. I think that's probably true.
Of course, other factors naturally entered into it, but... Yeah.
Miller was a driver, a very pleasing man. He could make a fine talk. She was a big, florid man. I think he had rheumatic fever. I was just almost very suddenly began to wither away, and he was gone. His heart just gave away. His heart acts. Mm-hmm. And it was just a great shock to everyone. He was a very flower of his life. He said, "Then he's gone." Mm-hmm. Spectacular. It was one of those very, very bad things. But you made a great contribution to the university, no question about that.
The medical...
I would say he probably was the most popular person. Mm-hmm. I believe he might have been. It was pretty hard to compare him with. The queue was so small when Dr. Weber was here. The points of contact are not enough. But when you compare the other three, I think without him, he was probably the most... Dr. Tiger wasn't too popular.
I was going to say, I've heard...
He was a very strong man.
Yeah, Dr. Tiger.
He didn't care.
Gave the impression to students particularly that he was somewhat elusive and cold.
Yeah,
that's true?
That is right. He was. Actually, he was pretty much that way until you get to know him.
Yeah.
And then when you get to know him, it could be a very warm and friendly man. He's part of it at home. Well, many times. Warm and friendly and jovial as you could be.
What do you think is the reason, the student attitude? Because this, of course, wasn't the years of the rebellious
some of
type
them, like,
student.
Even the athletes on the football, they'd go out and watch football practice. So the athletic was one. Mm-hmm. I guess under Dr. Tiger's administration, the College of Health and Physical Education, I'm sure, was organized and made this greatest advancement because he was strong for athletics of all kinds. Mm-hmm. and whatever cheaper that may be that you get full credit for. So she named after himself as an old football player. He had Flint Zimmerman, right. A strong football. So he was with that element of the UFC, he was perfect. He supported football, a good football program.
Mm-hmm. Miller was probably overall more popular than Tiger, with students and faculty, I guess.
Yeah.
56 then, you were not the department head anymore, and I guess you were glad to get back to research, is that true?
I sure was.
Pretty much. What
I had government grants. I had a government grant at that time. My total amount of government research grants over the from about 3 or 4 years before I retired to the 5 or 6 years since I retired, the first 5 or 6 years, they're over now, about $1.5 million, which is, for one man, quite a lot.
I had, on one
project, I had 30 or 40 people working for it.
This, you are considered now the research professor of chemistry and sanitation.
That's right. Part of this work was in pure chemistry, part of it was in engineering. It still is.
And the agricultural chemistry aspect.
That dropped a long time ago.
I was going to say
ago.
This was that something
dropped
else.
Dropped a long time ago. Right.
Let's talk about George Bowman a little bit. You and he are good friends.
He was in the business.
He's kind of a wheeler dealer, I've heard. You know,
he was in the business office, and he and I can't quite know why we got to be good friends. We did. I suppose our attributes may be somewhat similar. Mm-hmm. And he was a very ambitious man. I wanted to respect himself. And he did a fine job in the business office and putting in new practices and getting people to know the university better. Mm-hmm. And then, because of his reputation, he was called to New York University. Mm-hmm. And he went up there. And one reason why it was Dr. Heal, who at that time was president of NYU, was one of the men we offered the presidency to when we were looking for succession to Dr. Miller. Mm-hmm. And Heal came down, which I met Dr. Bowman at that time. That may be why, because he got the job, I don't know. Anyhow, George went up there and had a very successful administration there in Columbia. And I'm sure the reason why I was elected member of the College of Hall of Fame for Great Americans of New York University, I'm sure George Bowman was why I was in. I think I had the reputation of it because I had been in many research papers at that time. But the university is a big school. There were only at that time only 14 scientists on the college. And I was just retired about I resigned about Christmas time after 25 years of continuous service. Mm-hmm. Every 5 years, we meet in New York for a big dinner in honor of the people that we've elected. Mm-hmm. And we elect from all over the country people who have been here at least 25 years. And his nomination is pushed by enough people that they've been wild. And it was a very interesting experience for me. Mm-hmm. I've always felt that, I never asked George, and he never mentioned it to me, but I've always imagined that was one reason, at least why I got it.
What made him such a good business manager? Is there anything you could
I don't know.
Talk about
he was just really astute as he could be. Mm-hmm. And, put in modern business practices, was a good businessman himself. He made money investing in the town.
Perhaps computers type thing?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
For that type
thing. That's right. He was just one of these people that come along who've got imagination and drive and common sense. And that put those together, you got a successful man. And after he left, he went down, as you know, to South Florida. And became president of the New College, wasn't it? Is that the name of it? The New College?
Yeah,
it is. I think it is, New College. Where he had built up a whole campus under his direction. Well, he's quite a man.
I was going to say, he must be quite an individual.
He's quite an individual, very handsome young man. Mm-hmm. Still, at his age.
Let's talk about your research just a little bit. What is you consider probably your most important contribution to chemistry over the years? I mean, besides, of course, your teaching and so forth.
Let's talk about
pure research, maybe.
My most recent one would have to be the most important because I think it's going to revolutionize water treatment throughout the United States and throughout the world.
This is what we were talking about the other night.
Mm-hmm. We have, we sulfur waters, and we have coagulation of that activity and take out cholera. They use chemicals of various kinds to do that. I have developed a method. It's a very unique thing. It'll take a long time to tell you the story of it, but it was where you all the things that you use to treat water are in the water itself. Calcium, magnesium, carbon dioxide, all the three things. I can give you a paper which a press release which the American Chemical Society gave out when I gave the paper in Washington 3 years ago. If you want to, you put it with the record if you want to, it tells the whole story of it. But no matter whether the water is hard or salt, or clear, or as well water would be, or turbid, muddy river water, or colored water from swamps, that water can be treated completely with the chemicals in the water.
It's hard to believe this hasn't been done before, you know.
It'll cut people across, say the Philadelphia example. We have now active contracts with the cities of Houston, Dallas, Texas, a big power plant under construction, Kansas City, Cleveland, Ohio, got that last week, Pittsburgh, got that last week, and Philadelphia, six of America, major cities are studying this, and I think you heard the man tell me while I was on the phone last week. The people that publish these little things will be down next week, and we'll talk about it and get the thing together, and one of these will come out by fall.
About some of the chemical industries.
First one in the field of water, the other than another. So that's by far the most important. It's covered by a broad basic patent. I'm sure it'll be the most popular.
I should say.
Because it should be very, very well all day. But I think my work with iodine as a disinfectant is probably the standpoint of health, the most important. That was just before you came in, I called down to Lowell, the prisoners down south, and told them I'd be down tomorrow morning to check over some things. We are now 11th year of continuous disinfection of the water supply. There's three prisons with elemental iodine, because in many, many ways it's better than chlorine, which is a very dangerous chemical to handle, and very poisonous, very effective, but in situations like small institutions, tourist camps, freeways along the interstate highways, the national parks, places where you're not going to have expert supervision and supervision at all. You're going to have a foolproof system. Iodine can be fed out with equipment which has no moving parts, accurately, continuously. It's easy to handle. It's shipped in cardboard cartons. I've told you it's shipped in heavy steel cylinders. You ship 100 pounds of toilet, you ship 100 pounds of steel to hold it. And you ship the iodine in cardboard cartons. Put it around. And a very, very powerful disinfectant. So
I think
my work with iodine will probably, when the history books are written, be one. And coagulation is a thing maybe I have some here to show you.
Oh, good.
If I have no other candy back home. So, I may have. Yeah, here it is. This is coagulation, just my particular field. This is the year I retired, I guess, the year after I retired, 67.
Right.
This is a symposium on coagulation held in Germany, published in German. I was invited but couldn't go. But as they said, I was here. Here are the papers that were given all the way through, all in German. And here are the references to papers. This is one of my papers, one of my very first papers right there. But this little Dr. Bartow, I told you the story about him.
He never
saw that, you see, but I put his name first because I hadn't got my degree yet, and that was one of the parts of the deal. So that's why that's Black Bartow and Sandberg. Then here, the one or two, each person has one or two references. Mine start here, those two, that entire page, and down to there, about four or five times as much as anybody else at all, you see.
Dr. Swartz.
That's right. So then, recognition by foreign countries of your work is about the most objective way to find out whether you arrived or whether you haven't. And people come to see this from all over the world, all the time. Here, my most recent request for reprints, here's one from Israel, and here's one from the Smithsonian Institute, information, the Smithsonian Institute, and here's one from Egypt, and he has one. These came at the same time from Egypt. Mm. And one came from Ireland the other day. That's down there being big knowledge. So it's all over.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
So I've worked on the coagulation, which is a process of water treatment, in which the adhesion crumbled it is a coagulant, but it was replaced by all the other coagulants that are used now because water contains that adhesion, it contains calcium, it contains carbon dioxide. And by properly blending those and using what's in the water, you treat the water.
You must have a great sense of accomplishment.
It's been very happy. Mm-hmm. And I've done, there's a technique called microelectrophoresis. You find all this listed in here. Mm-hmm. It's possible by putting tiny particles in an electric field in little cells. You make them yourself. A very elaborate instrumentation required. And having high power light to look down by telling which way they go and how fast they go, you can measure the actual charge on those little particles. Colloid chemists have been using it for a number of years, but water chemists have never taken it up. So I picked it up in 1958. And within Miss Plifnich, she's a little Polish woman. I published the first paper ever published anywhere in the world on the use of microelectrophoresis for studying coagulation. And it swept the world, and now a standard technique, everybody has one, and they've been building in New York and still over the hundreds. So I initiated that whole new research area called microelectrophoresis, and there are other things. Calcination, recalcination. You take lime and add it to water and you get a calcium carbonate sludge, which is very bulky and of no value. We found that in Miami in 1949. Well, we saw that there for 22 years. But you can take that stuff and centrifuge it and get out most of the water. We burn it, recalcine it, and make fresh lime. And I built the first one in the United States and the second one in the world, the one in London, which has never been in a long time ago. So it's now the first one in the world. It's been operating all these years and been a tremendous financial success. And yet we had to build another one because they've got two more new water plants. Then I did the same thing at Dayton, Ohio. And out of those two researches came this new process of lime. Because I learned how to recycle. That's recycling, of course. You take the calcium and use it over and over again, and you get more than you put in. Mm-hmm. So in the early days of the Miami unit, they had lime to sell. As the city got bigger and bigger, they got more and more use. They had to buy lime again, and now they're getting ready to build a second plant. At Dayton, sale of excess lime over what we use for ourselves passed the $1 million mark in March of last year. Mm. So now we can recycle in my new process to discover that magnesium in water is better than any chemical that we've ever used, the iron salts or the alum salts. And the combination of lime and magnesium is all it takes to treat these waters. So I'll recycle the magnesium. And the product that I get out of it is similar to that I did. Mm-hmm. Magnesium carbonate. And there's the EPA publication. Mm-hmm. That work was done by the engineers there. That's the publication of the EPA. They based it on my patent work like that. This is the material. That comes out of water. And that's all you need to treat water. So I'll recycle it and get more of that than you need. And that's worth 16 cents a pound. Hmm. So now we're getting ready to finish up now this summer our recovery plan for the adhesion at Dayton. And we'll make from $300,000 to $500,000 a year. Our clear profit on material which we're now throwing in the river. Plus $1 million for 7 years for the recalcitrant. So I now recycle the adhesion, recycle the calcium, and recycle the carbon dioxide. Because the kill with which you do this gives you all the CO2 you need free. It was so simple that if I hadn't had the recalcitration background, I never would have found it.
It's fascinating.
We've always known that benzoyl hydroxide was a gelatinous, non-toxic, water insoluble. Mm-hmm. Highly absorptive material.